to decide which ones you wanted to print. The camera bombed. Customers simply didn't love prints as much as Kodak strategists thought they did. By now, business magazines and literature have assembled a rather impressive list of similar cases where once great companies ran into difficulties when trends changed the game, or their business models ran out of steam. Circuit City, Sears, Grundig, and Wang, just to name a few. So today's strategists are more likely to try to find an outside perspective and to bring it into the strategy room, but the inside game still makes it hard to act. For most businesses, the best predictor of next year's budget is still this year's budget, plus or minus a few percent, of course. Strategy processes often generate a high-level commitment to making a change, but too often, as with a failing dieter or a cigarette quitter, the processes don't surface and deal with other prior commitments that immunize companies against change. As one CEO told us, if you want a big idea done, you have to pursue it to the last detail. Just because the group said yes doesn't mean it's going to happen. Bringing about change in the corporations of today reminds us of an attempt to move an octopus when one leg of the octopus is totally committed to going to the next rock, but the other seven remain completely committed to holding on to the rock they're already grasping. Just changing mindsets won't be enough, though. The social side of strategy won't give up the fight that easily. A golf instructor won't help much by telling you, don't slice. He must give you something positive that you can actually do to solve the problem. Hence, we'll now lay out the empirical research that will provide you with an outside view. We'll begin by giving you a new way to map out your competitive situation, then show you where you need to go. It's going to be a bit of a journey, so stick with us. Chapter 2. Opening the windows of your strategy room. The power curve built from the economic profits of thousands of companies gives a fresh outside view of the universe of strategy as it really is. Before Christopher Columbus sailed for the New World in 1492, maps of the world were very detailed and very wrong. A typical one looked like the Fra Mauro map. Mapmakers who had experience with Europe drew that continent reasonably accurately. Here in the middle right of the chart, you have to turn it upside down because back then south was at the top. That's Spain, a fraction inside the black dot at the middle on the right, followed by the southern tips of Italy and then Greece as your eyes move left across the Mediterranean. But the mapmakers back then also drew Africa and Asia just as confidently, despite little knowledge of those unexplored coastlines. Not surprisingly, they missed the Western Hemisphere entirely. The map didn't make any distinction between the up-close familiar Mediterranean territories and the myths crowding the farther edges of the map. The map ended up being really full, no space for curiosity left in there. Thus, when Columbus sailed west from Spain, he thought he was some 4,000 miles away from Japan, when he was actually 12,500 miles away, with an unknown continent in between. After Columbus hit that new continent, at what we now call the West Indies, mapmakers realized just how much they didn't know and began limiting themselves. They drew only what they knew and left blank spaces for the explorers to fill in. Maps began to look like the Diogo Ribeiro map from 1529. This had the outline of the east coast of the new continents there in the middle, but left the rest for later, and what's more, was the right way up. In just a generation, the map of the world had been irrevocably transformed, a true paradigm shift. The continents aren't, of course, named North Columbus and South Columbus. They're called North and South America, named after an Italian, Amerigo Vespucci, who played the smallest role in the early voyages. He won the honor because while Columbus and many others never gave up the certainty of those old maps, Vespucci speculated in two texts that the islands that Columbus found were actually part of a new continent. A mapmaker accepted that argument in 1507, and mistakenly thinking that Vespucci had discovered the continent, named it America in his honor. When that map became popular, others adopted the name, and he was immortalized. All because Vespucci was willing to challenge assumptions. Yuval Noah Harari argues in Sapiens, A Brief History of Humankind, that the blank spaces on the new maps didn't just provide the right template for the age of exploration, they also ushered in the scientific revolution. He believes that the doubts manifested in these modern maps guided an entire class of scientists to leave blank spaces for others to fill in as knowledge increased in many scientific fields. The embracing of ignorance had to come before the embracing of knowledge. Upon reflection, we thought that the current state of strategy at times reminds us a bit more of those early maps. Good insights from a close-up view and surrounded by a detailed and compelling narrative with lots of analysis. It might feel as if the strategy room is jammed so full with slides and facts from the inside view that there is little leeway for curiosity and wonder about what the external view would say. There is simply not enough room left for uncertainty and exploration. By no means do we want to imply that we discovered a new continent, but we thought it might be helpful to start with conceding that the map for navigating corporate performance is not perfectly understood yet. With that, we set out to add some information to the map by bringing in an outside view to help you chart a new course for your business toward better performance. Now we commence our own tour of discovery. The right yardstick. Let's start creating the new map by setting a clear yardstick for good strategy, a proper compass to guide the way. Some would look at gains in share price, but that struck us as too mercurial, too dependent on the starting and ending dates of the measurement, and maybe also a bit too influenced by factors outside the control of management. Others would look at growth in revenue, yet others at earnings or cash flow. So, could one metric be the yardstick for business performance? Probably not. But economic profit comes pretty close, we think. At its heart, business strategy is all about beating the market, or in other words, defying the power of perfect markets to push economic surplus back to zero. Economic profit, the total profit after the cost of capital is subtracted, measures the success of that defiance by showing what is left on the table after the forces of competition have played out. Of course, businesses also pursue other objectives, such as delivering inventions, securing employment, or making social contributions and building communities. But if good strategy succeeds in taming market forces, residual economic profit will grow, making it also easier to accomplish the other objectives. Oddly, you won't find economic profit in any audited financial statements, and our surveys find it is rarely used in the world of strategy. Some executives even asked us, "Didn't we just throw EVA out the window?" Well, we're bringing it back. We believe it is a good metric, as it shows both by how much a company has beaten the market and the scale of that success. Not only does economic profit measure margin and scale, it also incorporates margin development, sales growth, and cash flow. If we have to choose one variable to measure an enterprise, or at least its purely economic contribution, economic profit could be it. Because we do lots of presentations on this work, we often get asked, "But what about returns to shareholders, or NPV?" Growth in economic profit drives shareholder returns, but is much less noisy and more under control of management. We found that over a period of 10 years, the top quintile of companies based on growth in economic profit delivered the strongest total shareholder returns, plus 17% per year, while the bottom quintile delivered the weakest, plus 7% per year. Economic profit captures the two parameters we know are driving share price performance over time: return on invested capital, ROIC, and growth. Besides, there are many commercial enterprises that are not listed on public markets, so economic profit is a more universally applicable measure. Let's get to know this yardstick a bit better. Exhibit 2. From 2010 to 2014, the average company in our database of the world's largest companies reported $920 million in annual operating profit. To make this profit, they used about $9.3 billion of invested capital, including the goodwill spent on past acquisitions. Dividing one by the other gives a return on invested capital of 9.9%. But investors and lenders in the average company required a return of 8% to compensate for use of their funds, measured by weighted average cost of capital. So the first $740 million of profit just made them whole. That left $180 million in economic profit. The spread over the average company's cost of capital multiplied by the scale of its business. Your business lives on a power curve. Once you plot all the economic profits in an ordered line, you find they demonstrate a power law. The tails of the curve rise and fall at exponential rates, with long flatlands in the middle. You get this chart pictured in Exhibit 3, called the power curve. To produce this chart depicting the power curve, we took financial performance data for 2,393 of the largest non-financial firms by revenue over the period 2010 to 2014 and estimated each company's average economic profit. The power curve shows each individual company's average economic profit over those 5 years, ranked from the lowest to the highest. Then we separated the power curve into three regions. The bottom of the curve, represented by the bottom quintile of companies, the middle of the curve, represented by the second, third, and fourth quintiles, and the top of the curve, represented by the top quintile of economic profit. There's a big gap from the middle to the top. The average economic profit on the top is 30 times greater. So if you're not at the high end already, the aspiration of joining the top-tier players should probably be on your mind. There are many instances of power laws in large data sets from economics, demography, and nature. The distribution of earthquake magnitudes follows such power laws, and so does the distribution of income for pro footballers, or book sales for that matter. Another example is Zipf's Law, which notes that the most frequent word in English, the, occurs approximately twice as often as the second most frequent, of, three times as often as the third most, and so on. Remarkably, this example of a power law holds for any language. While we expected a broad distribution of results for economic profit, the steepness of the tails surprised us, as did how flat the broad middle was. Going back to our maps analogy, we thought we were headed for Japan and hit the West Indies instead. And the tails are even steeper if we include the true outliers of economic profit. Companies like Apple live on Mars, two floors up from the profit curve of ordinary companies. They might inspire mere mortal business leaders, but practically, they don't fit on the scale of the chart, although they are included in our data set. Among other things, we realized that the extremes of the results render an average all but meaningless. If Jeff Bezos walks into an ordinary bar, the average wealth of the other people in the room would soar to more than $100 million, even though all the other customers' wallets remain just as slim as before. The average footballer's salary doesn't mean much, given the huge spread of figures. This is what life is like on a power curve. What we see on the map. Back in the strategy room, the power curve is not the map actually in use. Our inside view gives us a detailed look at how we compare with last year, with our immediate competitors, and with our expectations for the next year. But when we zoom way out and look at the landscape of profitability, at all major companies in all industries and geographies, we get an important new perspective. We see that the vast majority of profits are at one end of the curve and improve exponentially as you get closer to that end. So good strategy shouldn't focus narrowly on last year or on next year or on competitors. The goal of strategy needs to be to move to the right on the power curve. For most businesses, all those in the middle three quintiles, the practical challenge is how to escape the broad, flat middle of the curve and move up into the region on the right, where most profits accrue. We aren't saying there isn't any value in doing better than last year, of course there is. Nor are we saying that every company can make it to the top of the power curve. Garrison Keillor had his fictional Lake Wobegon, where all the women are strong, all the men are good-looking, and all the children are above average. Just as there is no Lake Wobegon in Minnesota, there is no performance panacea that can enable exceptional performance for all. But zooming way out and looking at the whole landscape of economic profit gives you a very different perspective relative to what you see when you just focus on last year and next year. It gives you a map to explore when charting your strategy. When we show the power curve chart to CEOs, it always leads to a good conversation driven by curiosity about where they rank. Mostly, the initial reaction is that this is common sense, but not commonly applied. It is not deeply appreciated just how long and flat the middle is, nor how very high the mountains are. There are several important insights we gain from the power curve. Market forces are pretty efficient. Textbook theory says that economic profits should tend towards zero over time because they get competed away. We're happy to report that, in most industries, profits are possible because real markets aren't perfect. The average company in our sample companies generates returns that exceed the cost of capital by almost 2 percentage points. But the market is chipping away at individual companies' profits all the time. That brutal competition is why it's so hard just to stay in place, and why hockey stick plans so seldom turn into reality. How many times have you seen that $100 million improvement program fail to drop money to the bottom line because all it did was keep your relative cost in line with your competitor? Rather than beating the market, the program was just part of playing along. You were keeping up with the Joneses. For companies in the middle of the power curve, the market is taking a heavy toll. In that flat part of the curve, all the hard work that people in the companies are doing often amounts to not much more than paying the rent. Companies in those three quintiles delivered economic profits averaging just $47 million a year. The discussion about the flatness of the curve in the middle simply isn't taking place in the strategy room now. The curve is extremely steep at the bookends. Companies in the top quintile capture nearly 90% of the economic profit created, averaging $1.4 billion annually. This is a hall of fame for business, with the top 40 companies including household names such as Apple, Microsoft, China Mobile, Samsung Electronics, Exxon, Johnson & Johnson, Oracle, Vodafone, Intel, Cisco, Nestle, Merck, Walmart, Coca-Cola, Audi, Unilever, and Siemens. The full list of top 40 companies earned $283 billion combined annual economic profit, more than half of the combined value for all 2,393 companies in the database, $417 billion. Overall, the companies in the top quintile average some 30 times as much economic profit as those in the middle three quintiles, while the bottom 20% make for deep economic losses. That unevenness exists within the top quintile, too. The top 2% together earn about as much as the next 8% combined. In smartphones, the top two companies, Apple and Samsung at the time, earned virtually all the economic profit. Yes, all the other mobile phone makers in aggregate destroyed value during that period. Apple earned more reselling memory in its iPhones and iPads than the entire memory industry making those very chips managed to capture. At the other end of the curve, the undersea canyon of negative economic profit is deep, though fortunately not quite as deep as the mountain is high. The curve is getting steeper over time. Back in 2000 to 2004, companies in the top quintile earned a collective $186 billion in economic profit. Fast forward a decade to 2010 to 14, and the top quintile captured $684 billion in economic profit. The bottom quintile generated a collective loss of $61 billion in 2000 to 2004. A decade later, the bottom quintile was losing $321 billion. Not surprisingly, investors seek companies that offer market-beating returns. As they do, more capital flows to the top. Managers may be able to fool their bosses, but they can't fool investors. Capital doesn't recognize or respect geographic and industry boundaries. Companies that started in the top quintile 10 years earlier soaked up 50 cents of every dollar of new capital in the decade up to 2014. This capital infusion enabled the top performers to grow their average economic profit by more than 130% in real terms over that decade, from $612 million to $1.4 billion. Even though their average returns on invested capital stayed relatively constant at around 16%. Even as the curve gets steeper, this is not a permanent inequality. As we will discover during the course of this book, companies and entire industries move up and down the curve. It is uneven, but also very dynamic. A firm's place on the curve changes all the time. Size isn't everything, but it isn't nothing either. In choosing a measure like economic profit, we know that size comes into play. That might create some feelings of discomfort. One might argue that a relative measure, such as economic profit margin or return on invested capital, should be used. But incorporating size in the measure makes sense. We evaluate the strength of a strategy based not only on how powerful its economic formula is, measured by the spread of its returns over its cost of capital, but also on how scalable that formula is, measured by how much invested capital it could deploy. See Exhibit 4. Compare Walmart with a moderate 12% return on capital but a whopping $136 billion of invested capital with Starbucks, which has a huge 50% return on capital but is limited by being in a much less scalable category, deploying only $2.6 billion of invested capital. Both are top quintile companies, but which had the better strategy? Well, that's a bit of a moot question, as they both generated enormous value. But the difference in economic profit generation is substantial. $5.3 billion from Walmart versus $1.1 billion from Starbucks. Size has its limitations, too. Larger firms, above average invested capital, make up 80% of all firms in the bottom quintile. If anything, we could say that larger companies are more likely to generate very high or very low economic profit. 28% are in the top quintile, while just 41% of large firms are spread across the middle three quintiles. To say it simply, it is easier to make a big profit or a big loss if you are big. However, it is really the combination of scale and spread that matters. In the end, it's you versus the world. You're used to comparing against your next-door neighbors and your own last 3 years. But it feels different looking at the whole world as it's represented on the power curve. Your horizon gets broadened, and you may be either chastened or emboldened, depending on where you find yourself on the curve. You look at lots of relative data today, but you can now see the whole playing field. This is where companies compete for the eye of the investor in terms of the performance they deliver. Relative to all other companies and not relative to their industries, this is where you see how effective strategy is over time in terms of moving companies up and down that curve. Some feel that it's unfair to be compared against companies in other industries and other nations, but that's the comparison that capital makes. It flows to the best opportunities no matter the industry or geography. Your main competitor is the Darwinian force of the market that squeezes your profitability. Your main measure of whether you are winning is the extent to which you avoid that squeeze. Why you are where you are. Even CEOs and CFOs are often surprised to see where they are on the power curve. It's not that they suffered from delusions. It's just that they're accustomed to an inside view. They compare their performance to peer benchmarks within their immediate competitors, not against the global universe of companies. Some CEOs are surprised to find themselves in the middle. They feel they are on top of their game or their industry. Some CEOs are surprised to find themselves at the very top of the curve and ponder whether it is their task to expand the curve or their fate to slide down. Wherever a company is, the question quickly becomes, why are we there? That question, too, leads to a surprise. The tendency when taking an inside view is that when things are going well, we attribute results to our management's unique recipe. When times are tough, it's an industry problem or bad luck. However, our analysis shows that a good 50% of your positioning on the curve is driven by what's happening in your industry, highlighting that where to play is really one of the most critical choices in strategy. Industry performance, we found, also follows a power curve, with the same hanging tail and high leading peak as shown in Exhibit 5. There are 12 tobacco companies in our research, and 9 are in the top quintile. Yet there are 20 paper companies, and none is in the top quintile. Well-known high performers such as software, pharmaceuticals, and wireless telecommunications jostle for position in the top quintile, while utilities, transport, and construction materials lumber along in the bottom quintile. The role of industry in a company's position on the power curve is so substantial that you'd rather be an average company in a great industry than a great company in an average industry. See Exhibit 6. The median pharmaceutical company, India-based Sun Pharmaceuticals, with economic profit of $424 million. The median software company, Adobe Systems, $339 million. And the median semiconductor company, Marvell Technology Group, $277 million. All would be in the top quintile of chemicals companies and the top 10% of food products companies. In some cases, you'd rather be in your supplier's industry than in your own. For example, again in Exhibit 6, the average economic profit of airlines is a loss of $99 million, while suppliers in the aerospace and defense category average a profit of $453 million. In fact, the 20th percentile aerospace and defense supplier, Saab AB, earns more economic profit than the 80th percentile airline, Air New Zealand. That is not to say that all airlines have poor economic performance, witness Japan Airlines, nor that all is rosy in aerospace and defense. But it is a fact of life that there are more and less attractive playing fields. Across the whole market, firms in the top quintile of the power curve get a boost of $335 million of economic profit just from being in better industries, while those in the bottom quintile suffer a penalty of minus $253 million from being in worse industries, as shown in Exhibit 7. There are, of course, exceptions that don't conform to the fates of their industries. For example, companies from integrated telecommunications services, a top quintile industry, are overrepresented in both the top and bottom company quintiles. The same is true for integrated oil and gas, a bottom quintile industry. But when it comes to explaining variance, we find that industry explains somewhere between 40% and 60%. And as industry definition gets more granular, the share of economic profit explained by the industry effect only increases. Even though all strategy presentations we've seen start with an industry view, that view is rarely carried forward to explain past performance. The old wisdom in strategy is that you have to know the real answer to the question, why do I make money? Industry is a much bigger reason than most people understand or want to accept, both on the upside, when tailwinds help us sail along, and on the downside, when the writing on the wall tells us tough times are coming and we don't like the news. Now that we have started drawing our new map and understand the crucial role of industry, let's head back to the strategy room and see what's different. A fresh perspective with the outside view. When you realize that success is very much defined by your company's and your industry's movements on the power curve, your perspective changes. Some companies have a low probability of making it to the top quintile, perhaps because of the industry they're in, but many at least have a shot. If you are aspiring to such a move, you are probably contemplating by now a few intriguing insights. The power curve is a new reference point you might not have used before. You're no longer comparing yourself with last year or your neighbor, but rather the full universe of companies competing for capital and economic profits. Success for your strategy becomes moving up on the power curve. Small success is moving in the middle flatlands. Big success is moving to the top quintile, and the reverse holds true for failure. Your aspirations need calibration. Incremental improvements aren't enough to get you moving, because your competitors are also working hard, and thus all your work might yield just a standstill. Moving up on the curve is not a one-year exercise. It is a journey that needs good strategy and sustained execution. The mountain is just too steep at the tails to climb quickly. The billion-dollar question, of course, is, what does it take to move on the power curve? Well, almost $1 billion. As we'll see later, companies that do jump up from the middle quintiles to the top experience an average lift of $640 million in annual economic profit. As we've said, success requires bigger moves than companies typically make. One client CEO traditionally framed discussions around 4-6% growth and resourced his divisions accordingly. One year, he did a much more granular analysis, business/country, and realized that one geography, Russia at the time, was growing at 30%. He swamped the Russian operations with resources, created a much more favorable environment, and it ended up growing much faster. The head of the Russian unit remarked, "I knew we could win, it's just that until now we never got the resources we needed, all because we used to just look at averages." Sometimes big success requires even more drastic measures, moving into a more profitable industry, or more favorable industry segments, tough to do. Or, if that's not in the cards, restructuring the economics of your industry to make it more attractive might be your only alternative. In setting strategic goals, most companies see hockey stick plans that rarely deliver the results they aspire to. The curious thing is that all of them are actually looking in the right direction. The way to make a move on the power curve is, in fact, a hockey stick. The challenge is telling a real one from a fake one. Shortly, we'll get to how you identify real hockey stick plans, but first, let's look at how fake ones are generated and the problems that result. Chapter 3. Hockey Stick Dreams, Hairy Back Realities. Hockey stick plans are a natural outcome of the strategy game, and are too often coupled only with timid moves. When successive hopeful forecasts pile up against reality, you get the ugliest chart in strategy, the hairy back. But real hockey sticks do happen. In a recent survey, CEOs attributed only 50% of decisions on target setting and strategy to facts and analytics. 50%. The other half they attributed to the strategy process and the dynamics in the strategy room. So, tasks like setting the right ambition levels and priorities are not just difficult technically, they also take place right at the intersection of the biases and agency problems we've discussed. The tasks are deep in the territory of the social side of strategy, where collective aspirations collide with individual fear, ambitions, rivalry, and bias. Even when the environment is perfectly understood, target setting is noisy. Overconfidence, blind extrapolation, competition for resources, the treadmill of rising expectations, or the typical desire for a goal setter to add stretch can cause targets to be set too high. Sandbagging, negotiations, and risk aversion will cause targets to come out too low. The consequence? Hockey sticks and hairy backs. The rise of the hairy back. As we've seen, the dynamics in the strategy room often lead to hockey stick plans. Overly conservative for the first couple of years, then overly aggressive longer term. These lines sail upward on the graph after a brief early dip to account for upfront investment. Over the years, unrealized hockey sticks string together, and the ugly cousin of the hockey stick appears, the hairy back. A real example of one of these, we have a drawer full of them, is shown in Exhibit 8. Look familiar? Do try this at home. Exhibit 8 shows the performance of a major multinational. The company planned for a breakout in 2011, only to achieve flat results. Undeterred, the team drew another hockey stick for 2012, then 2013, then 2014, then 2015, even as actual results stayed roughly flat, then trailed off. Hairy backs are common in sales, profit, utilization performance, you name it. Boards fear them, investors know them, and CEOs try to avoid them, but they keep happening. Some stem from overconfidence, a very human trait. When asked about their driving skills, 93% of U.S. drivers and 69% of Swedish drivers said they were above average. Asked to rate their safety, 88% of U.S. drivers and 77% of Swedes put themselves in the top half. These biases are shared by experts in many fields. The more experienced people are, the more likely they are to suffer from overconfidence. Social dynamics in businesses reward overconfidence. Whoever got promoted based on a growth forecast that didn't sail upward? Some, raised on a diet of self-help books, may even believe that setting stretch goals will motivate people, no matter how unrealistic these targets may be. So, quite a number of hockey sticks appear because people actually believe they can pull them off. Getting to yes. Others appear because people are playing social games. While the planning process is officially about strategy, the real goal is to get a yes for resources in that all-important budget for next year. Those resources are how managers maintain status and position themselves for the kinds of results that might get them promoted, even perhaps to the top job. Managers don't assume they'll get everything they request. They come in with a big ask so that even after the expected haircut, they'll get adequate resources. Besides, the punishment for not getting resources is generally greater than for not having a hockey stick pan out. You've seen the game and probably even played it. When a requirement is set, such as a 15% internal rate of return on investments, plans magically morph to just clear that bar. Nobody ever walked into a planning session intending to get a no to a plan. Nobody ever wants to lose the competition for resources. Imagine a manager coming into the room with a realistic but flat target. You'd wonder, is this person capable or ambitious enough? Has he really thought through his strategy with any creativity or flair? Doesn't he trust his ability to execute? No. Hockey stick it is. It's so much easier to believe what we want to be true. The CEO won't approve every hockey stick, but needs a growth story somewhere. Executive teams make lots of decisions, and it's hard to evaluate all the content all the time. So the hockey stick plan that gets backed generally comes from the person with the best track record. The CEO takes a version of that plan to the board, which may push back on some details, but generally supports the plans of the CEO. That's not the end of the story. A haircut from finance. Then the CFO, doing his or her job to arbitrate resources, gets hold of the plans, and the next phase of the game begins. The one that gets to the ultimate goal, that all-important first-year budget. The CFO, of course, can't live with any performance dip that a hockey stick shows for the first couple of years, the valley of investment, when results decline before the major growth kicks in. Too much cost-cutting would be required to cover for that dip. The dip would also consume the safety cushion the CFO wants to have in the budget to cover for the downside caused by something unexpectedly going wrong over the course of the year, as it always does. The CEO, while supporting the hockey stick aspirations, also recognizes the need for a cushion. There isn't much worse than missing your numbers after assuring the board you're safe. So the CFO gets to pull back resources, smoothing out the first year of the performance curve. Here is an email in one of our inboxes that typifies the point. Debriefing from a meeting with the global CFO discussing a major strategic reorientation of a business unit, another executive wrote, "She believes in the strategy, but wants, like any good CFO, to see how it can be done without the short-term earnings hit. She homed in immediately on the key issue of whether to spend on accelerated CapEx in the next 2 years. Regardless of whether a hockey stick was overly optimistic, the result of social gaming, or a real opportunity, this is usually the point when it becomes all but certain that the promised success won't materialize. The investment that was supposed to lay the foundation for growth has taken a haircut. But for some reason, all too often the ambition level for growth remains largely unchanged. At the end of the first year, sure enough, performance isn't living up to the hockey stick promise. Attribution bias kicks in. The problem can't be the fault of those cutting the investment. After all, managers signed off on their budgets. The missed target is then blamed on the most convenient cause available, which is usually some one-off event, unseasonable weather, an IT outage, etc. Even though such one-off occurrences seem to happen every year. With failure dismissed as an externality, the management team closes ranks and decides to double down and re-establish the goal. We lost a year, but we're going to get back on track. The next hair sprouts. As Daniel Kahneman and Dan Lavallo explained in their work on the human tendency toward bold forecasts and timid plans, we're inclined to see exceptional growth in sales, earnings, and other metrics, but won't make the big moves that could generate those results. They published their paper 25 years ago, but we keep making the same errors. In essence, we are saying, we're going to do a ton better next year by doing the same things we did this year, or maybe just a little more. Bold forecasts. Mark Twain beautifully summarized the typical problem with bold forecasts when he said, "It ain't what you don't know that gets you into trouble, it's what you know for sure that just ain't so." There is a lot of "we know for sure" around. In our speeches, we often ask for fun, how many people in the room believe that the Great Wall of China is the only man-made object visible from space? It continues to blow our minds that most people know that to be true, except it isn't. The claim, first made in 1754, has been known to be untrue since 1961. The first cosmonaut, Yuri Gagarin, checked it out when he orbited the Earth that year. He was unable to pick out the Great Wall with his naked eye, and no space traveler since then has, because the wall is made from rock that is indistinguishable from the surrounding terrain. Yet most people still know that the Great Wall is visible from space. When it comes to forecasting, several silent killers can creep into our strategy room. Some of the most popular ones include a lack of a proper baseline, errors about performance attribution, and especially, the ways we deal with uncertainty. The lack of a proper baseline. Our forecasts are built on things we believe we know. During the first internet boom, one of our clients was considering investing $1 billion in a new fiber optic cable network across the U.S., based on the estimates of the explosive growth in communication. It was clear that the advent of the internet would fuel demand for fiber capacity, and many rushed in to stake a claim. The more the internet revolutionized business and how people transacted, the more fiber capacity would be required. Everybody knew that. But that explosive, seemingly unlimited demand wasn't the whole picture. There was already a lot of fiber in use, and its capacity would increase at the rapid pace at which the routers that dispatched signals through the fiber improved. Then there was dark fiber to consider, installed capacity that was yet to be used. plus the announced plans of competitors for installing additional capacity. Add it all up, and the expected capacity would exceed even the most outrageous demand projections for the following 5 years. Because the company took the time to do a proper baseline and saw that what everybody knew just did not translate into a need for additional capacity, the company decided to stop the project and saved itself the $1 billion allocated to that hockey stick. The fact that barely a year later the internet bubble imploded was merely icing on the cake for their decision. Many others had invested without a proper baseline, simply acting on what they thought they knew, and paid dearly for it. Another evergreen problem with baselines is planning for market share gains. In the early days of the personal computer, every electronics company worth its silicon decided it could capture 20% of the rapidly expanding U.S. market, ignoring how many others were staking that same claim. 8 companies tried for 20%, the industry hopelessly overbuilt, and the shakeout was painful. Bold forecasts are hard to avoid. It's too easy to pull cells across the screen in Excel without paying heed to how hard it might have been just to get to the current point. You, like us, might have friends who plan to hit great times in a marathon, but fail to meet their expectations because they undertrained, firmly believing that they were already much fitter than they actually were. Businesses make the same sorts of mistakes. Errors in performance attribution. Errors in assessing business momentum are always easy to make. Often, performance is mistaken for capability. We've done so well, so we must be better than our competition, and will continue to prosper no matter what. Even though external conditions may have contributed to the success. These types of momentum mistakes are harder to spot when you're doing well, because the need to understand the underlying dynamics feels less urgent. If a company is prospering in an environment where it can raise prices rapidly, for instance, it may convince itself that it is becoming ever more efficient in its sales operations simply because the costs of sales are outpaced by revenue growth. When the pricing environment stiffens, however, the company may discover all kinds of inefficiencies that crept into the system. During the dot-com boom, several North American consumer electronics contract manufacturing companies expanded rapidly by acquiring factories of their customers left and right. Their share prices rose exponentially around stories of unmatched efficiency and logistics capabilities. When the growth story ended with the bust of the internet bubble, it came to light that, during the rapid growth, even the most basic integration of newly acquired operations had been neglected, exacerbating the effects of dropping volumes. The recovery took years, and several companies became acquisition targets themselves. We are prone to attribution errors even when they hurt us. We all cherish, for instance, the friendly family doctor. However, patients of doctors who are in the top quartile for customer satisfaction are associated with 9% higher medical costs and 25% higher mortality rates. A doctor who makes you feel good can put you in danger, but try telling that to a happy patient. A realistic perspective on corporate performance also tends to get obfuscated by stretch goals, or BHAGs, big, hairy, audacious goals. In setting those, leaders often put hope over facts. Managers with exceptional track records seem especially prone to willing their way to performance by setting unrealistically high performance bars, at times with negative effects on the morale of their teams. Many business books help to extend the perception that greatness can be easily achieved. Building from selected case studies, they imply that there is exceptional performance waiting just around the corner, as long as you adopt the right formula. It ain't. For a start, this loose causality ignores the gigantic role of industry dynamics. Not everybody can be an apple, no matter how long we cite them as a heroic example. In fact, probably nobody can. More precisely, in our sample, 1 out of 2,393 can. Still, books are written and people try, secretly attributing more capabilities to themselves than they have. How we deal with uncertainty. Predictions are difficult, especially about the future, quipped Yogi Berra, and before him, Niels Bohr. This rings especially true when trying to run a proper strategy process. Uncertainty is not only everywhere in and around strategy, it is the very reason why we need strategy. Without uncertainty, we just need a plan to go from A to B. The problem in dealing with uncertainty in the strategy process is not so much the analysis. While uncertainty is often missing from the analysis, and even proper scenario planning is still rather rare, the issue is, surprise, the social side of strategy. Why? At some level, it is easy for the CEO to deal with uncertainty by playing a portfolio game, knowing that not every bet has to pay off for the total play to work. The problem is that what is a portfolio game on the corporate level becomes a matter of all-in commitment for an individual business unit leader. We have all heard the saying, "You are your numbers." The saying isn't, "Well, that project only had a 50% chance of success, so I won't hold failure against him until he's had another similar failure or two." No. At the level of the unit leader, results are pretty much binary. You make it, or you don't. It's the very existence of probabilities and uncertainties that allows the social game space to flourish. The issue is noisy signals. We can't really tell if that poor result was a noble failure, in as much as we can't tell if the great result was blind luck. Was it a case of best efforts on a good bet but a bad roll of the dice? Was it a more pernicious failure of planning or execution? Was it perhaps just a bad strategy to start with? Uncertainty doesn't only mean we can't see around the next corner. Uncertainty also invades the past. That dust cloud in the rearview mirror means you can't really tell where you came from. Of course, in running a business, there are many elements that you just can't control. The fate of the economy, political events, and your competitors' actions. In most strategy rooms, the question on how to deal with uncertainty looms large. It's the 600-pound gorilla in the room. Actually, it's sitting in the middle of the table. It has long teeth, and it's drooling. Nobody wants to talk about it. It's a complex topic that can easily get in the way of getting a yes to the plan. But it's sitting there. So managers presenting strategies have sophisticated approaches on how to deal with the gorilla. They have to get a yes, not a maybe. That means they have to inspire confidence in the outcomes they are promising, providing at least an illusion of certainty. Here are some of our all-time favorites among the ways that people deal with uncertainty in the strategy room. First, ignoring uncertainty. Many strategy presentations we see start with an analyst-based projection of the market. Not scenarios, not a range of outcomes. They start with a most likely version of the future. And that's the last thing you heard about uncertainty in the presentation. From then on, you get single-point estimates for the plan, too, and it's a straight shot for the yes. What about treating uncertainty as an afterthought? The strategy room is a harsh place for most, and quite frankly, failure on that stage is not an option for most managers. Execution problems? Okay. A strategy that has gaps? We can fix that. But a strategy conversation about probabilities? You must be kidding. The result is a slide about risks on page 149 of a 150-page strategy deck. The presenter hopes to win a yes on funding before getting anywhere close to that far into the deck. That slide on page 149, titled something like "Potential Risks and How to Mitigate Them," is there just so the presenter can say the issue is covered if the odd question about risks should pop up. Finally, pretending to deal with uncertainty. In some cases, uncertainty is actually discussed in the strategy room. Say geopolitical risks are threatening sales growth in an emerging market, or a competitor could make an industry consolidating move. There will be a few scenarios, plus a discussion on which of them would be more likely or less likely to emerge. Then, one scenario is picked as base case, and that's probably the last thing you hear about uncertainty. Strategy clear, job done. There are, of course, businesses that could not survive without dealing with uncertainty. For example, in asset management and other financial businesses, risk-weighted metrics are normal. The difference is that they are moving money around. In more tangible businesses, you move people and money around, and also the careers and reputations of business leaders. While the calculator loses reputation by wrongly calculating risk, the manager loses reputation by giving up resources. All these common practices and related errors can lay the foundation for setting the wrong ambition levels and, consequently, flawed strategies. To be clear, there is nothing wrong about having bold targets. In fact, you need bold targets to move upward on the power curve. But those ambitions need to be anchored in the realities of a business and the evolving context it operates in. This book is about how to set bold targets, but to do so in a way that is equally matched by the boldness of the moves needed to achieve them. Timid plans. A recent McKinsey study of a large sample of big companies showed that over 90% of budgets on a business unit level are statistically explained by the previous year's budget levels. Most companies evolve in incremental steps as a result of cautious plans. But how do timid plans gel with overly ambitious forecasts and targets? Well, it starts with us being human. When it comes to making real decisions, in particular when these decisions have implications for our own families, careers, or wealth, many of us tend to be risk-averse. You might have participated in surveys your bank is obliged to conduct to determine your investor profile. The results of these surveys and many experiments by behavioral scientists clearly show that most of us are much more willing to forego a large upside to avoid a small downside. We simply do not like losing. But when that individual risk aversion gets projected onto corporate strategy, we hit problems. A large, diversified corporation with many investors, themselves diversified, will have a far greater risk tolerance than the middle manager who is the gatekeeper to the plans. The avoidance of downside at almost all costs happens all too often in the strategy room. Big moves are rarely proposed, and even less frequently accepted. The CEO of one of the largest Hong Kong property companies complained to us that none of his managers ever comes up with big ideas. When we asked him why, he responded, "Well, whenever they speak up, they cannot really articulate themselves, so I shut them down after half a minute." Guess what those who spoke up will do in the next meeting? Think about it. How often have you seen a business unit manager come into the annual planning cycle with a strong M&A strategy? How often have you seen moves proposed that would truly change the game in an industry? That just does not happen that often. Most discussions in the strategy room are about intensifying efforts to gain a few percent more market share or to squeeze out a few more percentage points of margin. That will show progress. Nobody will get fired. As we've said, we will show that this belief in incremental progress is a fallacy. Bigger moves not only increase your odds of success, but reduce the risk of sliding down. Still, the fear of downside risk pervades the planning environment. Nearly 8 out of 10 executives surveyed by our firm tell us that their companies are more geared toward confirming existing hypotheses in their strategy processes than in testing new ones. Going for incremental moves is the norm, not the exception. Corporate peanut butter. Avoiding conflicts in the team, being practical about the business, giving every team member a fair chance, keeping the motivation up. All these arguments contribute to resource stickiness. Corporate planning becomes more like your breakfast strategy, spreading resources thinly like peanut butter on bread, across all parts of the business, making sure everyone is covered. Almost by default, peanut buttering ensures that even if a hockey stick were possible, it would be hard for a business unit leader to get all the resources needed to pull it off. One of our high-tech clients with a core computing business with $26 billion in revenue wanted to build another pillar for growth. The company even went so far as to free up some resources from R&D and the capital budget. But then it decided to pursue